This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It is March 11th, 2013, and I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 284. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you may recall we heard Senate Bill 284 on February 14th. The bill in its original form directed the health authority to adopt rules requiring all infants born in the state to be screened for lysosomal storage disorders declared an emergency effective on passage. What you have before you is the Dash 2 amendment, which basically replaces the bill, and it is directing the health authority to gather data relating to infants who have the storage disorder and assess the feasibility of requiring all infants born in the state to be screened and treated for the storage disorders. It also has a requirement that the authority reports the results of this study to the Legislative Assembly on or before March 1st, 2015. It also sunsets March 2nd, 2015. Madam Chair, we have a no revenue impact on the Dash 2s, and if the committee chooses to adopt the Dash 2 amendment, it will have a minimal fiscal impact on the agency. Therefore, the subsequent referral to Ways and Means, if the committee so chooses, may be rescinded.
Okay, and there evidently Senator Steiner Hayward had some questions for, so Dr. Skeels, do you want to, Mike Skeels, do you want to come up? I can't remember if you're a doctor or not.
I'm not a real doctor.
I think that counts. You worked at least as hard as I did.
I thought we were going to make Katie King testify.
Basically, I think that I'll let Senator Steiner Hayward ask you the specific questions. But what the process actually is in dealing with getting disorders screened.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Yeah, Mr. Skeels, if you would, Dr. Skeels, if you would just be so kind as to help us understand a little bit more clearly how this decision is made. I understand that there's a national committee, and if you could explain that a little bit more and explain what criteria are used when you all determine which tests should be included in routine screening, and maybe even the difference between a routine screening test and a diagnostic test when there's a high likelihood that somebody might have the disease. That might be very helpful to the committee.
Sure.
Thank you so much.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, I'm Mike Skeels. I'm the director of the State Public Health Laboratory. I'm also the interim deputy state public health director for a few months as well. There is a national committee called the Secretary's Advisory Committee on Heritable Disorders in Newborns and Children that is tasked with the responsibility for recommending the so-called RUSP, the Recommended Uniform Screening Panel for newborns in the United States. And this committee is composed of experts in the field. They represent the American Academy of Pediatrics, American College of Medical Genetics, parents, advocacy groups, the Genetic Alliance, and a lot of other professional organizations. And they have an evidence-based review process by which disorders can be nominated, and then evidence-based review of the medical literature and everything that's ever been studied and published about them is examined. And then a recommendation is made about whether they should or should not be added to the recommended uniform screening panel at this time, or whether more information is needed or whatever. And Oregon, like virtually every state, adheres to the recommended uniform screening panel as the source of information for what we should be screening all Oregon newborns for. This is analogous to the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices that establishes what children should be immunized for, or the Clinical Preventive Services Task Force that recommends things like PAP screening or anything else. So there is a professional deliberative body that evaluates all the available medical evidence and makes these recommendations. So that's really the way that we go about deciding what should be on the Oregon panel. And you also asked about screening versus diagnosis. When you're doing population screening, you need a test that initially will identify every infant who has a disorder, hopefully, so it's 100% sensitive, it doesn't miss any, but it also doesn't overcall too many so that you don't have a whole lot of false positive results. And then for those that are initially positive, you do confirmatory or diagnostic testing, which has more specificity. So that's what we're looking for a screening test.
Thank you very much. So another follow-up,
yes,
Madam
please.
Chair. So, and this national committee has considered these lysosomal storage disorders for testing. And made the decision that they didn't meet those criteria that you described to us?
That's correct. The committee considers the whether or not there's a screening test that's available, whether it's practical and can be used in a high throughput or a situation, and whether there's a treatment that's available to that has been adopted that's successful for any disorder that you might identify. Four different lysosomal storage disorders have been nominated, reviewed, and rejected by the Secretary's Advisory Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean they can never be considered again. And I guess I'd like to get on the record that I hope at some point we will be able to screen for these disorders and there will be effective treatments for them. But that's probably 2 to 5 years down the road for most of them. But this, the National Committee has considered these and decided that they really are not ready yet.
May I ask one more question, Madam Chair? Thank you. And we heard at the initial public hearing on this that New York was already doing this screening. Do you have any sense of what New York's experience has been like in using this as a screening test?
Yeah, yes. New York was the first state to start screening for one of these disorders. That was Krabbe disease in 2006. Since then, they've screened 1.5 million children. They've found five infantile Krabbe disease cases and 281 false positives. And by that, I mean that they identify children who are at risk for developing the disease, but although they've been followed very carefully for years now, have not started developing symptoms. So from a screening point of view, that gives you a test that has 1.7% positive predictive value. It's right 1.7% of the time and wrong 98.3% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really not even in the ballpark for the kind of thing that we want to screen for. They have they're trying hard to make this work, but they've got two things going against them. One is the actual analytical method has a huge amount of variability in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an FDA-approved test. It's something they've had to develop and from scratch and validate themselves. But the other problem, and this one is actually worse, is that even if the test is working right and it can identify the specific biochemical problem that you're looking for, the test is not the problem that's... That particular biochemical marker does not predict whether the child will develop the disease. And so you have all of these kids, these 281 kids who they found that have lowered enzyme activity, meaning they are at risk of developing the disease, but in fact they don't have the disease and they probably are not going to get it. So that's 281 families you've told your child has a potentially fatal disease and we're going to have to follow them through time and so on and so forth. And sadly, of the five children that they've identified, three of them have died, and the other two are profoundly disabled and have a very poor prognosis. So they've spent $6 or $7 million screening 1.5 million children, and they found five babies that have it. They've found 281 false positives, and even the children who were detected, as far as I can tell, did not benefit.
Got it. So we're challenged by a test that isn't super accurate and a disease which sometimes, as is evidenced by this nice young man over here, can be treated with something as high intervention levels of bone marrow transplant, but sometimes that even that treatment, because I assume maybe one or two of those kids in New York had that treatment, isn't actually effective for the child.
Senator, you know more about that than I do. I'm not a physician, but I can bone marrow transplant, as you know, has its own risks. It has
right.
about a 10% mortality anyway. And of those children who died, I believe two of them had transplant. I'm not sure, and some of the others did have. But if you look at the literature in the field, bone marrow transplant can help for the short term in some children, but the long-term prognosis is really unproven. The other promising kind of therapy that's coming along for these disorders is enzyme replacement therapy, so that you can just replace the missing enzyme in the child. There was a large study published in January of this year that says that there are, I think, 7 or 8 different FDA-approved enzyme replacement therapies out there, but that they really are not, they're still experimental. And the dosage hasn't been established, the protocols for treatment have not been established, and the conclusion was that they're not quite ready for use yet either, but we're hoping that they will be.
Thank you so much. No further questions,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Thank you so very much, Dr. Skiles. I really appreciate this information. What I am hoping that when you conduct the research that's needed on lysosomal storage disorder, that hopefully we will have, research will prove a better test and maybe a treatment. All right, we are in work session, and we have the Dash 2 amendments.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 284.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 284. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 284 as amended with the Dash 2 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and request the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Oh, yes.
Wait.
Yes. Right.
You got it right. All right. Senator Cruz moves the Senate Bill 284 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with that and that the Ways and Means referral, subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Hayward.
Aye.
Senator
Snow.
Aye.
Senator
Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz.
Aye.
Chairman.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Boquist will carry this bill. And I want to thank Tammy Wilson, David Wilson, and their family for coming. And I'm hoping that we somehow, research will be able to develop a more reliable screening test as well as treatment. This enzyme replacement just could do wonders if we can address that. But I want to thank you so much for coming and bringing this bill to us.
Can I say something?
Yes, please come forward and introduce yourself.
So my name is David Wilson. I'm the father of these two boys here, Marshall, who's in the wheelchair, and Michael, that is, as normal, running around, destroying everything. so he was talking about the five early infantile children that got diagnosed in New York. There's actually four different onsets for this disease. The children that typically have the early onset, early infantile onset, the majority of those kids never make it past age two because it comes on so quick, whether it's right at birth or it's soon enough after birth, that there's not enough time to perform a transplant and save these kids. And some of these kids that do get a transplant, even though they're early infantile, they will be disabled in some fashion for the rest of their life. Now, like in my case, my two kids are late infantile onset, and there's juvenile and then there's adult. We know an adult lady that actually started developing symptoms. She got a transplant. She's doing well. I mean, granted, she's restricted to a wheelchair, but she's living a normal life. And so even though we had the five kids in New York that got diagnosed that did pass away or are severely disabled, that's going to be the case no matter what, unless there is some idea of actually doing transplants for these kids while they're still in the womb for the early infantile, because that's the only way that they're probably going to be able to save them. But right now, it's the late infantile, like my kids, and the ones that are older are going to be the ones that will be mostly successful with those kind of transplants. I know that the transplant that Michael went through, that one had a 30% mortality rate. He survived it. And we know that the main doctor, Dr. Escalar, who's doing transplants also back in Pittsburgh, she has developed a new system, and their transplant mortality rate right now is at 5%.
Right.
So I definitely think that's information you guys need to have.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I think I did close the work session on Senate Bill 284, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 325. Sandy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 325 extends the rural health practitioner tax credit to January 1, 2020. And this has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. So we do have a Dash 5 amendment that they'll review for you, and we do have a fiscal and revenue on this bill with the Dash 5 amendments.
Okay, Dr. Dodson, Dr. Plant, and Dr. Faust.
You guys go first. Okay, you two.
Please proceed.
Okay. My name is Molly Foss. I am a family practice physician in Hood River, Oregon, and I speak in favor of this Senate Bill 325. I grew up in rural Oregon in Drane, and starting in high school and through college, decided that I would like to be a rural family physician. Left for medical school, came back and did my residency in Klamath Falls, Oregon. So throughout that time, my dad, who's also a rural family physician in Oregon, tried to talk me out of it, saying that there's no future in rural family medicine in Oregon. And then when I was in residency in Klamath Falls, I found the job of my dreams at the end of residency in Hood River at a community healthcare and a community clinic, which provides medical care for underserved, underinsured, and generally disenfranchised patients. So I came back saying this was my dream job, and my advisor told me I was crazy to accept that kind of a salary. So by that point, I had decided this was my dream, but now I was married to an accountant, and so he decided that we had to figure this out fiscally. So the person that recruited me, however, knew the difficulty of that, and had some tools that she could use as well, one of which was potential loan repayment, but the other was this tax credit. And so using those tools and my dream, I also convinced my husband that it was an okay idea. And we've been successful in living in Hood River. So for me, it definitely helps us to stay there. When I heard about this coming up again for potential sunset, I talked to the rest of the people that I work with in our community health clinic, all of whom said that it helped significantly, two of whom said they would probably have to leave if we didn't have it. And then I decided to talk to a couple of other people who aren't in the federally qualified community health center. And one who's an obstetrician, I went in to help her with a C-section one night, and when you're standing there waiting for the case to start at 1 in the morning, you don't have anything else to do. So she said that it helps that she considered working in Portland, continuing to live in Hood River, but working in Portland because of the differentiation in salary, but has been able to stay working in Hood River, which is helpful. And then other people said the same. And I have other friends who actually do that, live in Hood River, which is a nice place to live, and work in Portland. So I have a couple of points. One is that working in rural Oregon, there is a differentiation in pay from urban Oregon, and the things like this rural provider tax credit really help make up for that. And they help provide retention of doctors in rural Oregon. That's one point. The second point is really the consideration of what is rural Oregon. And I think geographically that's a little bit of a tough decision, because you could say places like Hood River and places like Cottage Grove, which is close to Eugene, places like Hood River, which is close to Portland, you could say it's not really that rural. However, for some of our patients, getting to Portland to get their health care is just as difficult as getting to New York. I mean, it's so unthinkable to even get to Portland that we really do need to have health care providers in these communities in Oregon. So with that, then I would really recommend continuing this tax credit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Gary Plant. I'm a family physician in Madras, Oregon, just south of Molly and Hood River. We're about an hour north of Bend and 2 hours southeast of Portland. I came to Madras in 2004, have been there the last 8 years practicing, and the rural tax credit was, again, one of several things that allowed me to come there. I was fortunate enough to have some scholarships during medical school and came out with a relatively low medical school debt, much lower than students are currently coming out with. The rural malpractice subsidy and the rural tax credit were two tools that the state had to make it possible for me to practice in a town like Madras. Our clinic is a rural health center, a rural health clinic, and our community, our practice, has about 50% of combined Medicare and Medicaid patients. And so when 50% of your practice is Medicare and Medicaid, it's difficult to pay salaries comparable to my colleagues, even just to the south, in practices in Bend, where some of my family practice colleagues don't take any Medicare or any Medicaid. In a community like Madras, we don't have that luxury. If I don't see patients, nobody else sees them. And so our practice has historically been open to all payers. The rural tax credit has been as much as 5% of my take-home pay. And so when people have asked me, well, it's only a $5,000 tax credit, does that really make a difference? Yes, it does. $5,000 lets me take a vacation. $5,000 lets me put money into my children's college education funds. $5,000 goes a long way in a town like Madras. And as I'm recruiting people to my community, when we point out that really does make a big difference, it's a very important recruitment tool. It's also a very important retention tool. There's a study done by the Office of Rural Health where they surveyed people who are getting the tax credit and asked all of us, what would happen if? What would happen if the tax credit went away? What would happen if the tax credit was decreased? And the answer was 70% of the rural practitioners said that they would either leave or consider leaving if this tax credit goes away, which was astonishing to me that the number was that high. But if even a portion of those people really do leave, given that the tax credit goes away, the system begins to unravel in the rural communities. The loss of a single doctor in a community like Madras has huge ripple effects throughout the community. And so as a retention tool, it's very important to us that the rural health tax credit continue.
Thank you.
Chairman Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Dodson, and I am a family physician as well. I formerly practiced in John Day, Oregon, and I am now the director of the Area Health Education Centers program at OHSU. I do not receive the tax credit, but I did at one point in my career. I am mainly here to point out a few of the economic issues related to this tax credit. The Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute does a biennial study economic effects of Oregon's physician practices. The most recent study was released in January of 2013 based on the licensing cycle that ended in January of 2011, or I'm sorry, December of 2011. In that report, the highlights include that Oregon physicians contribute a total of $2,560 jobs, or 12% of the state's job market through direct, indirect, and induced employment. One physician on average contributes 23 direct, indirect, and induced jobs to the state labor market. The total added value to Oregon's GDP by Oregon physicians was $18.8 billion, or 10.1% of the state's GDP. The total estimated state and local tax contribution relative to Oregon's physician was $1.48 billion, and at the county level per physician, the total jobs contributed ranged from 11 to 52 jobs. The total contribution of the GDP ranged from $700,000 to $2.9 million per physician, and state and local taxes generated from between $60,000 and $220,000 per physician. The point being that there is significant economic benefit for the $5,000 tax credit, particularly in our rural counties where economic activity is certainly lower than in the urban areas. And I can reference this report further if you'd care to, but it's on the website for the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute.
I want to thank the doctors from coming from your practice many hours away. But Dr. Dodson, I have some questions for you.
Yes.
Would like to talk about the amendment. Are you the one to address the amendment?
I'm not sure what the amendment is. I don't have it in front of me.
Mr. Ekblad will do that.
Yes.
Okay. I was very pleased that the Oral Rural Health Group got together to see how we could make this tax credit maybe more efficient, see if there were any problems with it. And so there was a good analysis, because this is the first time that a tax credit bill has come to us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always, well, you just rubber stamp it. But we really need to look at how some of these tax credits maybe could be, make sure that they are doing what they were intended to do, which is to retain and recruit family physicians in particular to the rural areas. So I'll just wait to have Scott Ekblad address the amendment then.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Well, just a question for Molly. I mean, you know, you say Hood River's your dream job, but you were in Drain.
Drain is a wonderful place. I'll tell you, the big difference is I minored in Spanish in college, and hardly anyone speaks Spanish in Drain, and it's about 50% of my day in Hood River.
Okay. Well, I'm a Douglas County guy. I just had to put that in.
Any further questions for this panel? Thank you very much. All right, with that, I would like to call Scott Ekblad and Josie Wisser from Tax Fairness. Jody Wiser. Is it Wiser?
Mm-hmm.
My constituent.
I knew it, Jane Wisser. Spelled the same way.
You're not going to move this to the right.
Yeah.
Thanks.
All right, Chair Mama Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health. The Rural Practitioner Tax Credit is administered by the Oregon Office of Rural Health. It was created in 1989, and the first awards, tax credit awards, were made for tax year 1990. At first, it was for only three different professions, and three or four others have been added throughout the years, so that now it is open to physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, certified registered nurse anesthetists, podiatrists, dentists, and optometrists. Just over 2,000 providers qualified for the tax credit in tax year 2011, representing $8.5 million. For that year, the fiscal impact for the biennium will be approximately $17 million. I was not working in the field when the program began or when it was created by the legislature, but I think it's safe to assume that the intent of the program was to increase the availability of providers in rural Oregon. And since 1991, the number of physicians receiving the credit has increased from 538 to over 1,200. And the number of nurse practitioners and PAs has increased from 115 to 665. I believe that if this credit is allowed to sunset, we would see a decline in the number of providers available in rural Oregon. And I believe that that trend would continue over time as current recipients see this program as more of a retention tool, even more as, important as a retention tool as it is a recruitment incentive. So this past summer, the Oregon Rural Health Association and the Office of Rural Health jointly administered a survey of the people who at that time received the tax credit. And I will lead you through some of the information we gathered and then talk about the resulting program revisions we propose in the Dash 5 amendments. So I'm going to skip over some of the stuff I've already talked about, but I thought I would add that prior to 1999, there was a 10-year limit on the income tax credit. That limit was removed by the legislature in 1999. Also thought I'd point out that requirements for eligibility for the tax credit vary by the type of provider, and I think that's probably just a result of providers being added in different legislative years and different criteria being present at the time. However, for all providers, at least 60% of their practice must be spent in a qualifying rural area. For the purposes of this program, rural means...
Senator Shields?
Yes.
Scott, can I interrupt you? I want to make sure that I understood. So it's not everybody gets up to $5,000. It's some kind of sliding scale depending on your profession or specialty?
Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Shields, the maximum credit is the same for all the professions, but the participation, the criteria for participation is a little bit different. For example, for dentists, you have to be practicing in a community of less than 5,000 people. And dentists also are required to have an agreement with the local hospital that they will come in emergency situations.
But the dollar amount's not different. It's just the criteria for...
Correct. Okay. Exactly.
Thank you.
For the purposes of this program, the definition of rural for eligibility purposes is being at least 10 miles from a population center of 40,000 or more. And you'll see on the next slide the map of what exactly that means in the state of Oregon. Everything that is green on that map is considered rural for the purposes of this program. The orange and the red sections are the communities that are more than 40,000, and the yellow around them represent a 10-mile radius from those communities. So anything that's within yellow or red, a provider would not be eligible for the tax credit based on the geographic eligibility. The difference between light green and dark green is rural, dark green is considered frontier. Frontier. The definition of frontier is six or fewer people per square mile. The next slide simply shows the number of recipients in each of the specialties from the year 1990 up to 2011, which is the last full tax year for which we have data. My apologies for the print being just a little bit small on that one. The next slide shows the same information, but in a different way. As you can see, the majority of recipients of this tax credit are physicians. Next slide breaks that down even further. The next page in my testimony shows the distribution of recipients of the tax credit. And I met with some of you individually before this hearing, and you might notice that the map is slightly different. And the reason is that we went back and the first map that I was using used everyone who's currently in our database, including those that we had already gotten information on for tax year 2012. And so that map included people who qualified in 2011 but won't qualify in 2012 because they have moved to an urban area. And that's why there was one person in Beaverton and there was another one in another obviously non-rural location. So what I did is I went back and had my data coordinator create a new map that looks strictly at 2011 recipients for this tax credit program. And then also put in the footnote that we already at this point in 2013 know that there are 55 recipients who received the credit in 2011 mm-hmm. that have since moved to a non-qualifying area. Hopefully that makes sense. Feel free to interrupt me if you have any questions.
Madam Chair,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Eklund, do you have a slide on here anywhere that talks about the types of physicians that are included? I mean, for example, a few years ago, back in 2007, we revamped the malpractice premium subsidy. We determined that it would only support physicians who are what we termed critical access specialties, the people you don't want to have to drive more than 50 miles to see, basically. And do we have any, I'm just reading actually through ORS right here. It doesn't look like there's any that kind of restriction on this. It's pretty much any type of physician or nurse practitioner or whoever. It could be any subspecialty at all?
Correct. Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Steiner Hayward. The critical access specialties is a designation that was created entirely for that program. It's not used anywhere else. For the medical malpractice subsidy program, excuse me.
Okay, and given that, do you have any information? I mean, for example, in the Dalles, you've got 100 people in Hood River, 85. Those look like two of the biggest. Grants Pass has 177. Do you have any sense of the specialty distribution in those areas? I mean, I would assume that in Christmas Valley, we're not talking about having neurologists or plastic surgeons out there. But I'm just curious about whether we know anything about these areas where there are a lot of the people receiving the credit.
We could certainly get that information, but I don't have it handy at the moment.
Okay. Thank you.
I think that one of the new criteria that we are proposing in the amendments would get at that issue in that if there is, for example, a non-primary care subspecialist that's providing some level of service in Hood River, for example, but as long as and they really are only actively practicing for that portion of time, as long as 60% of their practice is in Hood River, they would get the tax credit. One of the changes that we propose in the amendments would be to make that a half-time FTE or 20 hours a week, actually, is the way it's stated. So hopefully that sheds a little more light.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
But I would like you to follow up with taking the big items the 85 in Hood River and the 100 in the Dalles, and I guess the others are all reasonable. 47 Newport, 47 Florence, 63 in Astoria. It would be nice if we knew what professions.
Chair Monis-Anderson, I now recall that I did actually prepare that for Hood River, and I do have that with me. It's just not here at the table, so I'm happy to come back and shed some light on that.
Thank you.
But I can do it for the entire state, as a matter of fact. As has been mentioned, the survey that we did, we sent it to, at the time, it was 2,067 people, and got over a 50% response rate, which is really pretty phenomenal. It gives you an idea of how strongly recipients of this tax credit feel about it. The next slide gives you an idea of the licensure of the people who responded. About half were MDs and DOs. Probably third were PAs and NPs, physician assistants and nurse practitioners. Next slide gives you an idea of how many years the respondents had been receiving the credit. The next slide talks about how significant the tax credit was in their decision to practice in rural Oregon. And as you can see, to the vast majority of the people who responded to the survey, it was either very important or important. Also asked whether the tax credit had been more valuable as a recruitment tool or a retention incentive. And interestingly, the majority felt it was a very important retention incentive. We also knew that people would be looking at ways to revise this program. It, after all, has been the same since it was instituted in 1989. And so we asked some questions, and I've included the information that led to our decision to propose the changes that we are proposing in the amendments. When asked, would you continue to practice in rural Oregon if the recipients of the credit were required to practice a minimum number? You can see the results there. The majority of folks were fine with the proposal to institute a minimum number of hours practiced rather than a percentage of the practice as it currently stands. Also, how would they feel about a requirement to accept Medicare and Medicaid patients in the same proportion of the as exists in the county? You can see that the vast majority felt that that would be a reasonable requirement. Then we asked, what would the impact be on your decision to continue practicing in rural if the credit were limited to 10 years? Well over 400 people said it would make them consider leaving their current practice location. About 300 said they would begin looking for other opportunities, and a small percentage, but I think noticeable percentage said it would make them leave their community as soon as possible. How about if the credit were eliminated? The results were pretty much the same. And then we asked an open-ended question and a couple interesting points I thought I would mention. Of over 1,000 respondents, 371 decided to answer an open-ended question. And the overwhelming majority reiterate the value of the credit in recruiting and or retaining their colleagues. And also, many mentioned that it lessens an urban-rural pay differential. So with that, that's the conclusion of my formal testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions for you or, again, come back. Oh, talk about the amendments. That's a great idea.
Just one question I have for you. When you're looking at, I would leave my community as soon as possible on the impact on your decision to continue practicing in rural Oregon, I'd like you to address the amendment where you have changed from an average over a month of 20 to 24 hours.
Sure, Chair Monis-Anderson. The suggested revision is from, as it currently stands, the provider is required to spend at least 60% of their practice in a qualifying area. We're proposing we change that to an hours per week or actually averaged over a month. And the reason for that is your immediate assumption is that 60% is 60% of 40 hours a week, and that's not always the case. If, for example, you are in academia and your only clinical practice is in a qualifying practice site for 5 hours a week, that's 100% of your practice and you'd be eligible for the credit. So it's really aimed at weeding out folks who are not providing a substantial level of service in a rural community and instead making sure that they're practicing at least half time.
Thank you.
Sure. And the other part of that amendment is, I'm sorry.
No, please go ahead.
The other part of that amendment is to require that they keep their practices open to the same level of Medicare and Medicaid as exists in their county. Just like we do with the medical malpractice subsidy program, which our office also administers, with the annual renewal, we send out the latest data on how many Medicare patients are in their county, how many Medicaid patients are in their county, and have them attest to the fact that they will keep their practice open to that level. This amendment also, however, puts a maximum on that to what is the National Center for Health Statistics saying what's the national average of Medicare and Medicaid in the typical healthcare clinic practice. The reason being that unless you are getting a federal grant to see publicly insured and the uninsured, such as in a federally qualified health center, or if you're a rural health clinic and get enhanced reimbursement for Medicaid patients, you really can't afford to see the level of Medicare and Medicaid that exist in some of the counties. There's also a great variation of what the level of Medicare and Medicaid is from one county to the next, and it didn't seem quite fair that someone would have to see twice as many as a physician in a different county. So,
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would make a prefatory remark that this is, in general, obviously the kind of tax credit I support, because I think keeping healthcare providers in our rural communities is a really important thing. That being said, I've been sitting here actually reading the statute with the current definition and then listening to what you've been saying. And I apologize for not having brought this up to you or others beforehand, but I'm kind of doing a just-in-time mode of operation these days. I guess it seems to me that the boundaries for this, the sort of rules about who qualifies for this, are markedly broader than who qualifies for the malpractice premium subsidy. And if the issue is how do we attract the right kinds of health providers to the right areas in the state, and therefore how do we use our tax incentives or other state dollars most effectively, I guess I'm struggling as much, for example, to understand why we need this in Ashland any more than we needed the rural the liability subsidy in Ashland, which is not exactly a tough place to live. I'm really eager to continue this tax credit. I just want to be really smart about it, okay? And I guess it'd be interesting, I don't know, there's probably not a way to do this, but it'd be interesting to parse down on your respondents to see whether the ones who said they would leave are the ones who are in Christmas Valley or the ones who are in Ashland, or, you know, whether they're primary care providers or critical access specialists or whether they're subspecialists who are doing part of their time. I think it would be really helpful if we could have a little more clarity around those data, and I'd like to know your thoughts about providing some of the same sidebars on this that sidebars isn't quite the right word. What's the word we're looking for? Anyway, the same rules for this or very similar rules for this as we do for the malpractice subsidy.
Well, Chair Monis-Anderson and Senator Steiner-Hayward, I guess it depends on what the motivation is. If the motivation is strictly to reduce the fiscal impact, then there's all kinds of ways that we could disqualify people from the tax credit. To me, it's just as important for a rural resident to have reasonable access to a general surgeon as it is to a family practice physician or to some sort of non-primary care specialty care. So, I think with the medical malpractice subsidy program, it was really intended to try, and that program was originally really intended to try and retain obstetrical services in a rural community, and that's why there's a real differentiation between obstetricians and family practice physicians who do obstetrics and the level of their premiums that are covered versus the other specialties that they get a much lower percentage of their premiums paid. And so I guess it just depends on what the intent of this particular program is.
Just a quick clarification, if I may. General surgeons are included, actually, and they're included in that critical access because they are the people that we really do want. I mean,
right.
They qualify as among the peoples. But your point, sure, is well taken. I think we have to be thinking, my comments are not meant to solely figure out how do we cut the fiscal impact on the state in that regard, but how do we think about this from how are we getting the most bang for our buck? And are we giving it to the right, giving these credits to the right people in ways that generate the right kinds of results for our communities? And that's the question that I think we need to be asking. Although in general, obviously, I'm supportive of this credit, considering how concerned I am about improving access across the state. So, yes, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I just point out that there's a difference between a tax credit and a subsidy, and I think on the malpractice subsidy, we looked at what we could afford, and similar in this, but it's harder to get an appropriation potentially than it is to do this. Okay, it's what I'm saying. I mean, because this has been in place for a long time. I think personally, rather than shrink this one, I'd like to expand the other one. But
okay,
as far as who's covered.
Okay. Any other discussion? Jody?
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. It's nice to chat with you. The last time I thought about this bill was a month ago when it was in the other committee. And Scott and I had some conversations, and I have not seen the amendments. So I feel like I could be way off base in some of what I want to say. But when we looked at what this bill is doing, we thought one of the biggest problems is the geographic parameters. I know a dentist who lives in Vernonia. He's eligible for this tax credit. He's doing extremely well in comparison to the other people in Vernonia. He's been able to buy his building, another rental building, pay for his equipment, etc. And they went to Vernonia not because of any of these benefits, but because they wanted to be close to an urban area, but in a rural area to raise their children in a rural area. And that's that same kind of thing would be true for a lot of the practitioners that are near the I-5 corridor. And it's a huge percentage of the people on this program. And having grown up in a community where our hospital and doctors serve people in a 50-mile radius in every direction from the community, because it was 100 miles to the next communities, which were mostly about the same size. It was about 152, a town where you would see a specialist. We did not expect to see eye doctors, foot doctors, people to deal with allergies, and all of those kind of specialties in our town. But it was really important that we have a hospital and someplace where we could go get antibiotics and deal with immediate emergencies. And that's the kind of thing that it makes sense for us to make sure we have in rural areas. And so as we talked about it, you know, we just tried to imagine ourselves, our team tried to imagine ourselves as a doctor locating someplace. And we could easily imagine that there would be doctors who chose to live in Salem and practice in Silverton. And there would be doctors who chose to live in Silverton and practice in Salem, because they're people who want different kinds of places for their families to grow up. And that we needed to change the geographic parameters to address the fact that it's not that far between Salem and Silverton, whether you're seeking medical care or you're choosing a place to live. We commonly, I mean, most of us are commuting, 50 miles a day to be in this building, as a matter of fact. And so it's not unusual to commute to work much more than 10 miles. And so we asked Scott to come up with some figures, and they're
computer system is fabulous. The data that they have is fabulous. So you could play with this any way you want. Thing we asked them to do, we said, instead of communities of 40,000, what happens if we go to communities that are 20,000? Because that's quite a different size community. And if we said 20 miles from, you had to be 20 miles from instead. And so recipients that are in communities over 20 million and less than 20 miles from those communities. Grants Pass would have 170.
20,000.
20,000, yes. 20,000 people, 20 miles. Grants Pass would have 174 physicians. Yamhill would have one. That really tells you right there a huge difference in what is available in those two communities and how much we're subsidizing communities that are really fairly rich in having medical practice available to their residents. And then you come to, the more we thought about it, we thought there's this other thing that we also found on Scott's website about medically needy communities. Because obviously if you have a small town but you have plenty of dentists, we don't need to try to be getting more dentists to come there with this benefit. And you can have the same size small town with no dentist. And then you really do need to incent someone to get there. And so it is really complex. But certainly just saying 10 miles, within 10 miles of a community of 40,000 leaves a huge part of the desirable part of the state available to the benefit. And that's probably not necessary. There are parts of the state where there are very few medical practitioners, and it's a long ways to get to something. And those parts of the state definitely need incentives. But in any of those rural areas, the cost of living is lower, but the medical bills aren't necessarily. And the stature of being the doctor is much higher in a smaller town than it is in a big city as well. I mean, if you're in a little town, you can be a doctor, but there's no private school to send your kid to, you know? But you're still, everybody knows you're the doctor because there's only two in town. And so all of that is part of what you look for when you're looking at what to do. So we've given you a set of suggestions of things that you could think about, and perhaps they're all addressed in the amendments. I have no idea, having not seen them. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Shields?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I would like to thank Scott for always being responsive whenever I've had a question over the last couple of years about how this plays out. Also wanted to thank one of the proponents of the bill, Doug Barber, for being very responsive and very transparent in all the information, putting it out there so that we can make a good choice, regardless of whether or not it, supported a particular hypothesis or not. So I want to thank you for doing a very good job bringing us the information that we needed to make a decision. I'm very supportive of this program, but I would like to be associated with the comments of Dr. Steiner Hayward, where I would be interested in if the chair could hold off on this, passing this through to the Tax Credits Committee for just a little while to see if we could figure a way to narrow it down a little bit. And also to take a look at the underserved populations generally. I mean, I was just talking to two retired physicians in my office today who said that their practice basically went under because they couldn't compete with the salaries that were being offered at hospitals or other communities for providers. So the main point being that even though, Multnomah County, has a number of physicians, Hood River, for example, has more primary care providers per capita than Multnomah County does. But we've got access to care problems all over the state, and I think we're all in this together. And so I want to see if we could also try to figure out if there's a way to serve underserved populations throughout the state, because I just think it's so desperately needed to make sure that we have experienced providers throughout the state in every community, regardless of where they are. So if you could hit the pause button, Madam Chair, I'd love to roll up my sleeves and help work on this. And thank you for bringing this forward.
What I would like, Scott, is if you could take the testimony from Tax Fairness of Oregon and the comments made by Senator Steiner Hayward and Senator Shields and look to see if there's anything more that your office could do to address some of the concerns that they have.
Sure.
All right. Any other comments? Thank you very much. We will be getting this back. Hopefully, you can get these conversations going within the week or week and a half, because it's already almost mid-March. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 325 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 456. Sandy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 456 appropriates $400,000 from the general fund of the Oregon Health Authority for the nutrition program for low-income seniors. You have submitted testimony from Senator Dingfelder. She couldn't be here, from Senator Rosenbaum, who was unable to attend, so we want to acknowledge their written letters of support. We also have written testimony from the Health Authority on 456, from Sue Woodbury, who, the program manager of the WIC program, who wasn't able to attend either. So just wanted to highlight that. We also have the fiscal impact statement. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, Madam Chair.
Okay, do I just start?
Absolutely.
Okay. Is Andy Short here?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Andy Short for Senator Jackie Dingfelder, Philip Kennedy Wong, Cassandra Griffin.
Is he coming back?
Who?
He's not going to. Thompson's not going to testify.
No, not on this one. The next one. 757. He's testifying on 757, not on this one. Okay, please proceed.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andy Short. I'm a legislative assistant for Senator Jackie Dingfelder, who represents parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland and Maywood Park. First of all, I'd like to thank you for hearing this bill. This is a very important bill to the senator. In a more perfect and fair world, after a lifetime of work, each older Oregonian would have the means to cover all his or her expenses. These seniors would have no trouble paying their rent, electricity bills, medical, and prescription costs, and they would still have money left over each month to purchase food. However, far too many seniors in Oregon often have to choose between simple expenses that many of us take for granted, such as deciding whether to purchase food for tonight's dinner or a week's worth of necessary medication. For these seniors, there's something we can do to help. We can expand the Senior Farm Direct Nutrition Program. This program provides vouchers to low-income seniors and served over 31,000 seniors in every county in Oregon in 2012. However, current funding levels for this program only provide vouchers for about half of all eligible seniors. With the modest increase in this bill, we can provide vouchers to an additional 6,000 low-income seniors. Through the senator's work with the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, she's learned that a lack of sufficient nutrition in seniors is often associated with a diminished health, which can lead to dizziness and falls, causing injuries requiring a walker, wheelchair, or even costly nursing and hospital care. With Senate Bill 456, we can help low-income seniors purchase the nutritious food they need, and ultimately, these seniors can have a better chance of staying healthy, while also supporting our local farmers. I ask that you join the senator in supporting Oregon seniors through the Senior Farm Direct Program and support Senate Bill 456. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Sanderson and members of the committee for record, Philip Kennedy Wong. Oregon Food Bank is here in support of Senate Bill 456, and I will keep my comments very brief. As you know, hunger is a challenge for the state of Oregon and obviously the entire country. And I wanted to take this opportunity to share with you a survey that we've just done recently that sort of highlights the breadth of hunger in the state and to show also which portion of the folks that we did survey to find out how many of them were seniors. So you should hopefully be getting in front of you this little report that looks like this. So once you get it, I want to turn your attention to the inside when you open it up. So this was a result of like over 4,000 emergency food
recipients who took a survey to give us a better sense of who is hungry in the state of Oregon. So when you take a look at Oregon Food Bank, we have 20 regional food banks and 945 nonprofit social services across the state that gets food from the food bank network. So we're essentially the food distribution system for social services. So when you think of social services, there are many that are dedicated to serving seniors. So when you think of Meals on Wheels, you think of, you know, care centers where seniors, you know, will congregate, to church programs where they have a meal program where seniors will come once a week. So I want to turn your attention to, if you look at the household composition, the age of the recipients, and if you sort of collapse like the highest age group, so from ages 55 to 69, and obviously 70 years of age or older, that's roughly 18% of people over the ages of 55 coming to an emergency food program to get food for their basic needs. And for us, I mean, when you think of like the 81 million pounds of food that we distributed last year and the same amount that we'll be delivering this year, in fact, even more, it points to the fact that there are a lot of seniors out there that's going hungry. You can take a look at also the list of why emergency food, and you can run through the list of the costs that it takes for a person to meet their basic needs. And when you're on a fixed income, obviously, as a senior, with food prices being where they're at, with the cost of electricity, so on and so forth, a lot of their income is going towards these other items, and it's not going to food, which kind of brings us back to here. So Senate Bill 456 would obviously help seniors with, you know, a modicum of resources to purchase fresh produce so they can, you know, obviously maintain their health. And just a quick fact, so of the 81 million pounds of food that we did distribute last year, we get roughly 8.5% of that in fresh crop donations from, you know, local farmers and also sources from outside of the state. So obviously for here, I mean, for us, for Oregon Food Bank, we recognize that the food bank system alone can't provide the food needs for everyone, and this is why why it's important to have this program for seniors out there. Thank you.
Senator Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Cassandra Griffin. I'm the Food Policy and School Health Program Manager for Upstream Public Health. I'm happy to be here with such good company today to testify in support of Senate Bill 456. Upstream Public Health has been working significantly on farm-to-school and school-garden programs since 2006, as all of you know. We believe that Oregon's children, farmers and processors, all benefit when Oregon products are served in schools, and we're happy to say that many people agree with us. We also believe that our seniors are another important, underserved, and often hungry segment of our population, and for all the same reasons, we believe that it's useful to help get Oregon's farm fresh produce to them. In 2011, Upstream Public Health conducted a health impact analysis in coordination with OSU economist Bruce Sorte to study the impacts of farm-to-school programs. One of the things he found is that for every dollar spent on foods produced or processed in Oregon, there was an economic multiplier of 1.67. So that means that if the same math applies here, a $400,000 investment in produce for Oregon seniors will result in over $1 million in additional economic activity for Oregon's rural communities, which suffer from hunger and poverty of their own. So on behalf of the seniors, the farmers, and Oregon's rural communities, I'm happy to be here asking you to support House Senate Bill 456.
Thank you very much. We did have a testimony from Sue Woodbury, the program manager of the WIC program in the public health. Is she here? No. And I don't know if you can answer this question, but we'd be allotting $400,000. How, in implementation of this program, would you know that that money is actually going to go to seniors? Because we have a huge need for low income, no matter where. Mm-hmm. Do you want to come?
Sorry, yeah.
Okay.
You need it.
Yeah. Is there any questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And then let's call up Robin Johnson, Ian Tolson.
Senator Mattis Anderson, members of the committee. Pardon me. My name is Bruce Catilius. I'm the Center Administrator for the Center for Prevention and Health Promotion at the Oregon Health Authority, just for the record. And I'm sorry, Chair Mattis Anderson, I didn't hear your exact question.
Well, I know that we would be designated $400,000 it would be designated for low-income seniors. And when you disperse the money, is it a logistical nightmare to make sure that $400,000 is going to be used specifically for low-income seniors, or will it benefit everyone and there's so many who need assistance that we're not meeting their needs? And I know this has just narrowed it to seniors.
Senator Mattis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm not certain that I can answer your question specifically, given that I'm not at the program level. I know that we have administered this program previously and have been able to identify the appropriate target recipients for this program. And the feedback that I've gotten from the program is that they're confident that it would be able to work similarly in this case. But I don't want to misspeak to your precise question.
It's an expansion. It's more money into something that already exists. So I think the parameters are there.
So there already exists something for low-income seniors, is what you're saying?
Senator Mattis Anderson, members of the committee, that's my understanding. This program does exist, and that would be an expansion of the existing program.
Thank you very much.
That's it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ian Tollison, and I represent Oregon Farm Bureau. Thank you for hearing this bill today. You've heard from the previous presenters that it really does fill a gap, and, you know, it's a short bill, about 10 lines, but it has a large impact. It has a large impact on this population that needs to get nutritious food. It has a large impact on the farmers I represent that try to get their food to people who need it. So it does a great job of bridging that gap. And Chair, to answer your question specifically, I think this is a smooth-running program from what I understand, and it's just recognizing that and putting a little bit more effort into it, into a good program. So
thank you.
I urge your support.
Thank you.
Chair Mattis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Robin Johnson. I'm the public policy manager for the Oregon Hunger Task Force. Thanks for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 456, which addresses the important issue of state funding for senior farm direct nutrition programs. I feel like all the pertinent facts have been adequately shared by the previous testimony, but just wanted to let you know that while we were able to serve just over 32,000 seniors last year, unfortunately there were about a little over 7,000 seniors that weren't able to be served, who asked for the program that did not receive the program. They received something called an I'm sorry card. And that, when I spoke with the Oregon WIC program who administers senior farm direct nutrition programs today, that struck me because we saw it as a significant growth over last year, which is a positive in that we know that the message of the program, it being available, is getting out there, but still is a deficit in that we're not able to serve these seniors. So I believe the committee clearly recognizes that seniors require greater consideration towards their health and medical needs that can be compromised when there's not enough food to eat. And we're also concerned with what's happening on the federal level, particularly with sequestration on other senior meal programs like Meals on Wheels and also the Commodity Supplemental Food Program. So this is another concern that has been sort of new into the mix with the 5.2% cuts in sequestration on the federal level will not impact this program, but will impact other senior feeding programs. And so it's another thing that's come into concern, become a concern to us. And so with that, I'll leave it with the Oregon Hunger Task Force respectfully asking you to support and pass this bill. And I'd be very happy to answer any questions.
Questions? All right. Is there anyone else to testify on this bill? Ivan Maluski, would you like to?
Thank you.
Chair Mattis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Maluski, Friends of Family Farmers in Molalla, Oregon. to testify in support of Senate Bill 456. You've heard some good arguments of why it's needed. I think one thing I would add is there has been a lot of uncertainty in this funding created at the federal level. If you follow federal farm policy, you realize that we haven't been able to get a farm bill done, and there's been a lot of, and it's been up to the last minute and these types of things. So part of the reason why we need to administer this program at the state level is to help ensure that we've got stability in this program, which is very important in providing healthy food to seniors who need it. I can testify as someone as well who's actually participated in the program as a farmer. It is the Oregon Health Authority already has a very important role in it. They do trainings for farmers to help make sure they know which products can be legally distributed. They do on-site visits to your farm to make sure that you're a legitimate operation and that you're not just buying produce at the store and then marking it up. So I think it's a well-run program. The Oregon Health Authority already does a good job. So we would certainly urge you to continue and to help fund it at the state level to help make sure that stability exists so that seniors can get good fresh produce from farm stands and farmers markets and directly from producers. Thank you.
Great. Just one question. So a low-income senior would have to prove that they're low-income when they... Yes, Robin, can you come up?
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, the way that it works is there's a partnership on the state level that sort of identifies the seniors. So DHS gives a list of eligible seniors to the WIC program. Let me look back. Yep. Okay, look, I'm getting the yes nod. And they give those names to the WIC program, and then they send out an invitation card to all of those. Mm-hmm. So these are seniors at or below 135% of poverty, clearly not all the way up to 185% of poverty where we serve all with SNAP, but just a small section.
Wonderful. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you. I will. Senator Cruz?
Not a question. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 456 and open a work session on Senate Bill 456.
Just make a couple comments. Number one, to declare a potential conflict of interest because I do have a farm market and we do... this program there, and it's been much easier once we got the card sized right. That really helped a lot, and thank you for that. This is a well-run program, and I think it's incredibly valuable. And with that, Madam Chair, we have no amendments or anything, do we?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 456 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee of Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 456 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a prior reference to the Committee of Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Sanger.
Aye.
Senator
Snow.
Aye.
Senator Joe.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries and... With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 456 and open a public hearing on 757. And Ashley, would you go get Senator Thompson?
He's not coming.
Oh, he is not going to come for this bit.
But
okay.
He did submit his written testimony.
Okay. Sandy, would you bring us up to date on this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this again is authorizing the Health Authority to operate the Senior Farm Direct Nutrition Program by providing financial support in specified circumstances. This, too, has an emergency effective on passage. This bill, we do have a dash one amendment, which is just correcting the title of the program in the original bill, more technical and Scrivener than anything substantive. And it is just a public hearing today, Madam Chair.
All right. So we do have written testimony from Senator Jackie Dinkfelder.
Correct.
And her staff isn't going to testify on this bill, correct? No.
Did you want to?
Okay. So and with that, and then Senator Chuck Thompson also submitted testimony in support of this. So with that, I would like to call Philip Kennedy Wong, Robin Johnson, and Ivan Malusky.
Good
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, for record, Philip Kennedy Wong, representing Oregon Food Bank. Ivan Molesky just asked me to share with you his regrets. He had a prior commitment and could not join this panel. I'll be very brief, since a lot of what I wanted to raise I brought up in the hearing for Senate Bill 456. Oregon Food Bank is supportive of Senate Bill 757. For us, obviously, it has to do, if you know, with changing statute to authorize Oregon Health Authority to be able to administer the program, especially in light of what's happening on the federal level, given that the Farm Bill status being uncertain and with provisions in it expiring, which you know, which would make it, I don't know if the best way to characterize it would be, it would make it difficult for the state of Oregon to carry it out without having the authorization from this body. So essentially what this bill would do is correct that to allow Oregon Health Authority to administer this program, which is why we are supportive of it, and that's why we were supportive of the prior bill.
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Okay, we've got the program that we just enhanced, and now we're doing a cash program on top of that.
Oh.
That's what it says in the bill.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I'm trying to figure out what's different about this approach than what we just did.
Yes, Senator Sandy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair Cruz.
Yes, ma'am.
The bill that we just passed is a partnership between the federal and the state.
Right.
If the federal legislation of the Farm Bill never passes, this authorizes OHA, singularly the state, to operate the program.
So it's a backup bill?
It is a backup bill, basically.
It's a just-in-case bill.
It is just, technically, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm looking at lines 2021 where it says may administer the program to provide checks or other payment mechanisms, and I just... We've got the program we've got. If this is to back up, if the feds don't do it for us to back it up, I would hope that we're not changing the parameters of what we're already doing.
Robin, why don't we listen to Robin's testimony, okay, and then we can address the issues.
Certainly. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 757 is put forward to ensure that Oregon is able to use and distribute funds for farmers market nutrition programs in the absence of the federal authorization and merely that. On the program level, the vouchers that we call them vouchers, technically they are called checks, and that's why you see the language written as it is in the statute.
Those are checks?
They call them checks. We call them vouchers. That's the term that WIC uses. Let me look over my shoulder.
Would WIC like to come up?
So I think this is a good. Yeah, that's.
I mean,
that's
Chair,
why it says
my whole
that.
Thing is we have a mechanism in place,
right,
and we have our vouchers, and I'm just looking at language and saying,
right,
we're going to a different mechanism to do the same thing. I just want to make sure.
No, not at all. It's the same mechanism.
Okay.
So, sorry to confuse things.
The interchangeability of the word voucher and checks, and that's what Senator Cruz was.
Yeah, well, I saw checks there, and I thought, okay, we're another payment form into this program. I just want to make sure that we're all talking the same thing, and we aren't changing the way this is administered or the way they redeem these things, or what's redeemed, actually.
Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, that's my understanding we would be talking about.
Oh, introduce yourself.
I'm Bruce Cotillius. I'm the Center Administrator for the Center for Prevention and Health Promotion at the Oregon Health Authority.
Okay.
It would be administered in the same way it currently is. It's just a matter of having the authority under those circumstances that were previously outlined to distribute.
Okay. Just the word check kind of threw me for a minute there, so
thank
it's
you.
Okay.
It's okay. I just had a couple more points to
yes,
my testimony,
please.
And we'll let you off the hook on this one. Or you'll let us off the hook. You know how we're So as Philip correctly pointed out, the Congress extended the Farm Bill for 1 year starting the beginning of fiscal year. 13 in October, but they didn't do that until January. So the deal is that there were 3 months when we were uncertain whether or not we would be able to distribute funds. And so if we don't have the authorization from the Congress through USDA, we can't even distribute the modest state funds that we're able to support this program with. And so that's really the intention of Senate Bill 757, is to make sure that in the absence of federal authorization that we'll be able to give out, we'll be able to support seniors with fresh food and farmers with that economic stimulus.
Excellent. So. That really clarifies. That's why we didn't put it up for work session, because we weren't really sure what this bill was supposed to be.
There was some language here that just threw me just a little bit, but thank you for the clarification.
Okay. Any other questions?
All right. I have one more thing. I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. Senator Cruz, you just asked previously when we were in, when I visited you in your office, you had asked a question about a potential subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this bill, and we were able to check with LFO, and they said that it would only be referred to LFO if there were a work session scheduled to make sure there didn't need to be a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Does that make sense? But our sense is that there does not need to be.
Madam Chair, my question basically was, because this is dealing with the expenditure of funds, and this is an authorization for expenditure of funds, I just wanted to make sure that this should go with the bill we just passed to Ways and Means, so they have both vehicles there. And I'm not sure what the answer is.
And the bill will be reviewed by LFO if there is a subsequent work session scheduled.
Okay.
Very good.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much. And I think we will wait for the paperwork on this. And when we get it, it doesn't look like there's any opposition to the bill. So
no.
I think that we'll be moving it forward as soon as you get it. That, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 757. And are we done for the day? Okay. We're adjourned.